And emerging technologies lab, we have a whole range of projects going across our Energy Futures program, where we look at digital energy futures in one of our projects, our Smart Home for Seniors project, where we've looked at how seniors use smart home technologies in their homes, our collaboration with the City of Melbourne, where we've looked at how city data and sensor technologies can be used to make city futures better for people and use in ethical and responsible ways. That's just three examples, and we work with amazing and interesting government partners to be able to really achieve things that we could never do on our own as academics.
Hi, Smart Community friends. In this episode of the Smart Community podcast, I have a great chat with Sarah Pink, founding director of the Emerging Technologies Research Lab at Monash University in Melbourne. Sarah is a futures and design anthropologist, and in this episode, she tells us about her background in both anthropology and as a documentary filmmaker and how this has shaped her career. We then talk about some of the projects that Sarah has been working on with the Emerging Technologies Research Lab, including some key insights from some of these projects. Sarah and I discuss why you need to start projects from a place of values and outcomes rather than starting with the data, and how we can enable people to connect with technologies with their human values. Sarah also talks about a really interesting and powerful approach called thing ethnography that involves role-playing people as technology in order to understand what people actually want from their technology, not just what technologists think that they want. We finish our chat discussing the problem of smart city debates being driven by people who don't understand real-life context and why we should be simulating future experiences to get a better understanding of how people behave in order to better plan for the future. As always, we hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
Welcome to the smart community, smart regions, smart towns, and smart cities. It's where we live, work, and play. With smart communities, the future starts today. Big data, smart mobility, emerging trends galore. The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hello, Sarah. How are you today?
Good, thank you.
I'm so excited to have this conversation with you. So let's just jump straight in. And can you tell us about your background and what you're passionate about?
Okay, so I originally trained as an anthropologist and anthropological documentary filmmaker. And that training has influenced everything I've done in my whole career. At the moment, I'm a professor and director of the Emerging Technologies Research Lab at Monash University. And in that role, my agenda is to engage social science, anthropological, sociological, and design-related methods that we learn from, to learn about human futures in the context of emerging technologies and also increasingly in the transition to net zero carbon emissions.
Excellent. Yes, this is why I was so excited to have you on the podcast. As we talk about in smart communities, it's all about the people. And I've been doing a lot of listening to podcasts and things lately and reading and stuff like that. And like, you know, when we talk about the history of technology and the future of technology, you can't talk about that without the social, you know, and the people and how people use that technology, what political things are happening at the time, all those type of things. So, yeah, I'm excited to have this conversation with you today. So let's just start. We'll get into the projects and things and the research and things that you've been doing, but let's start broad. And what is a smart community to you?
For me, thinking about a smart community, my first thought is always that it's the people who are smart. Right. So as you're saying, you know, people are so central to should be central to all of these discussions. And people are smart. People have always been smart. You know, how do people use technologies? How do people improvise and innovate to make technologies work for them? We see so many examples of the things that people have done with technologies that are surprising and that actually turn those technologies into things that have a capacity and capability that they would never have had before as the kind of technologies that are designed to be smart by engineers. So smartness is very much about that negotiation between people and technology. It's not something that technology does to people.
Yeah, I really like that. And I think when I talk to people, particularly in regional areas, that's one of the things that comes out in terms of like innovations. It's like innovations by necessity, or there's like a newfound use for something that someone in the city would never have thought about because they don't need that service or whatever the case is. So that's always really interesting to see like how people use technology and then how it evolves over time as well. So let's dive in. Tell us about some of the projects and things you've been working on.
So in the Emerging Technologies Lab, we have a whole range of projects going across our Energy Futures program, where we look at digital energy futures in one of our projects, our Smart Home for Seniors project, where we've looked at how seniors use smart home technologies in their homes, our collaboration with the City of Melbourne, where we've looked at how city data and city and sensor technologies can be used to make city futures better for people and use in ethical and responsible ways. Yeah, that's just three examples. And we work with amazing, interesting government partners to be able to really achieve things that we could never do on our own as academics.
Yeah, cool. I'm really keen. I mean, all three of those projects sound super interesting. Maybe the seniors one. Tell us a little bit more about the scope and then what you've learned through that project.
Yeah, so in that research, we collaborated with McLean Care and with Deakin University to do a study of a trial, a test, where a series of senior households, actually in New South Wales, in rural areas and towns, had a whole suite of smart home technologies installed in their homes. So digital voice assistants, smart lights, smart kettles, whole range of different things. And we studied them and worked with the seniors to understand how they use those technologies, in what ways they might have increased their well-being, enabled their independence, and a whole range of things like that, to just to kind of get a sense of actually what really happens when people who would never otherwise have had those technologies in their lives and their homes, what really happens when they get their hands on them, and how do they make them meaningful for them?
Yeah, cool. And what were some of the key insights and some of the things that surprised you?
One of the things that we discovered is that, you know, you can't just put smart home technology in seniors' homes and then expect the technology to, because it's smart, you know, enhance their well-being or their independence. What we found is that actually those smart home technologies came into people's homes, that they came in as part of a service. The whole tech research team and our social research team actually supported that process. So what we really find is that it's not technology that alone that can make a difference. And I found this consistently across many projects, that actually when you bring together technology as a service with a human service, that's when you really get the best out of it. And also when, of course, you understand the people who you want to benefit from that service and you shape the service with them rather than creating it before and then just doing it to them. I think in terms of like some of the specific things, you know, we've had some wonderful findings in that project. So some of our senior participants really enjoyed using the digital voice assistants for things like listening to music and not necessarily to control, sometimes to control other devices as well. But there are these kind of wonderful well-being aspects where we watched our participants ask the digital voice assistant to play music from that they found on the internet, right? And just the joy that people experienced having their whole room filled with music that they absolutely loved. So, yeah, it was a fantastic project to work on, wonderful participants as well.
Yeah, nice. I guess, like, when you were building the project with them, I guess, like, you know, kind of a co-design process, what are some of the things that you did differently based on that feedback that you got from the participants?
I think what we learned from the participants was, you know, what worked for them and what didn't work for them. So, for example, they found some of the smart kettles. Some people loved them, but sometimes they were too heavy, not completely suitable for seniors. We found that the smart lights are incredibly useful for seniors. And, you know, just in terms of learning about what really works for people. Of course, if you're a senior, then one of the things you're most worried about is a fall. Because for an older person, a fall can really be the end of your independence. It could be the end of your living at home, or it can mean hospitalization for a significant period of time. So to be able to just use a button from your bedside or a voice command to ask the smart lights to come on and light your way to the bathroom at night was just absolutely just so important for people. So that kind of thing was really significant as well. Like, the core message is really about ensuring that technologies, the way in which people can use them and the data which is collected and that people can gain access to is meaningful. We had similar situation in the City Sensing Data Futures project that we did with the City of Melbourne. We really found that the human values, understanding human values, needs to come first. So we set about working out what the human values of the people in the City of Melbourne were, and how those could be connected to the kind of data about the city that could be collected. and how that data might be useful to the people as well as to the city. Right. So it's really always about understanding people's values and then trying to think about how technological developments and smart tech and those kinds of advancements can actually really help.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's so key is starting, you know, a few projects I'm working on at the moment, even getting, you know, going, oh, okay, what data have we got available? Well, no, actually, that's not the starting point, right? It's what's the outcomes we're trying to achieve? What problems are we trying to solve? And then we know that we can get these pieces of the data and knowing what's available is obviously really important, but not starting there. That's after you work out what the solution is, because otherwise you don't want to build the outcomes around the data that you know is available, because there's also a whole range of other data sources that we can either collect or merge together or might be available we just don't know about yet that we can then
use. Yeah, look, exactly. And it's also, I think, very much a case with data is, you know, just don't just collect it because you can. And, you know, there's lots of data that can be collected. But where do you stop? Where is it ethical to stop? You know, where does collecting the data actually kind of exceed the values of the people who the data is being collected about? But where does collecting particular data actually work for people? So I think we found that, you know, people are much more concerned about personal data about them as individuals being collected, but they're much more open to kind of broader data being collected, which will help them to navigate their lives as individuals. So in Melbourne, our research was undertaken in Argyle Square, which is a part of the city that the city of Melbourne has installed many sensor technologies in. And those sensors were detecting how many people walked through the park. There was a bench seat sensor, which would count how many people sat on the bench. Environmental sensors to telling us about the environment, and also sensors telling us, you know, how people were using the bins, the rubbish bins. And so those are examples of this whole range of sensors. And we interpreted them as being actually as a family of sensors. And we really wanted to do that so we could humanize them and enable people to think about them in terms of the kind of human values that they might embody. You know, and I think that's also very important to enable people to think about technologies as being able to actually connect with their human values and helping to make that happen. So, and we've used various techniques to do that. So in some of our projects, we've used what we call a thing ethnography technique, where we've actually asked people to role play a technology. And of course, if you ask a person to be a smart technology, that person will bring that very human smartness and the human values, the human ethics, into their interpretation of how the technology should act. So that's exactly the reason why we asked people to embody these technologies, to role play them, to pretend that they were the technologies, and then tell us what they would do if they were the technology. That's a very kind of important way, I think, of making sure that the technology doesn't kind of remain an abstract thing which kind of acts on its own, because humans are always driving the way in which technologies act. There are human values, but those human values might not be the right ones, especially when they're embedded in those complex power relationships where certain organizations are driving those technologies, certain organizations are making the decisions about what data they collect. So taking that back into the community and enabling the community values to be part of how technology is designed and how it's used is so important.
I really like that. And yeah, to even think about, me as a human acting as a technology, and then if I was that technology, or if I were that technology, what would I actually be doing? And getting people to think, it just shifts your thinking so significantly, right?
Yeah. So we said, you know, to the people in Argyle Square in Melbourne, we said, well, you know, if you were a sensor, what data would you collect? Where would your limits be? Where would you stop? What data wouldn't you collect? What would you do with the data? Who would you share it with? All of those kinds of questions, which enables us to think about where do those boundaries have to lie, right? So that was wonderful. And one of our other projects, in our Digital Energy Futures projects, in this project, we learned about how people are increasingly starting to buy more and more air purification and filtration technologies and put them in their homes. And it's also happening in organizations and schools and other sectors as well. And we really wanted to understand how people envisage their future home-based air technologies, and also how they thought about air purification, filtration, and air conditioning as all part of the same system. So we asked people to invent their future air technologies, which were usually tech which combined air filtration, purification, sometimes dehumidification and other capacities and air conditioning, all in the same technology. And once we'd asked them to invent their technologies and the specific characteristics that have to suit their home and their household, then we asked them to role play the technology. And the participant in the research was the air technology, but the interviewer played the role of the energy grid. So they actually had this conversation between, you know, the possible demands and needs of the energy grid to potentially direct or automate the way that energy was used and accessed, but the sometimes competing needs of the household. So how would the piece of air technology protect its family and look after its family in a particular event where there might be increased energy demands, where there might be bushfires, or there might be an asthma thunderstorm or particular need for more electricity, and kind of putting it into those kind of values of human values of care, caring for your family, looking after your family, protecting your family, which is essentially, you know, what air technologies would be used to do in the future, I think. We were really able to understand how that kind of relationship between automation, potential automation and control by an external force was perceived by families and households, and how they would like to actually manage those relationships in the future.
Yeah, wow, that's so interesting. I'm just imagining the grid talking to the, and like you said, like they're more combining. So just say we had to choose, you know, you would go, oh, well, you know, my family has, like, I don't know, my child has asthma or something, so I'm going to prioritize that technology if I have to choose between whatever it is, and that ends, you know, different times of day and all that type of stuff as well. Yeah, I lived in South Korea for a bit, and the air purification, it was my kind of first exposure to it in buildings and everything like that with the air quality. And then having, you know, you don't just look at the weather, you also look at the air quality every day as well. So very interesting. And I guess like people becoming more and more aware of it, and obviously living in cities and that type of thing as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think air quality has become a key issue for us now in this decade, especially through the experience of the pandemic, during which, of course, people purchased more air purification and filtration technologies. And also, of course, especially in Australia, as I said, in relation, you know, to the asthma thunderstorms, the bushfires, all of those pollutants that can actually damage the quality of our air. It's super interesting, actually, how quality cars are now having much more advanced air filtration and purification systems installed in them as well. So you can imagine all kinds of futures where we are potentially protected from the air around us, in our homes, in our cars, by technologies that actually purify that air and enable us to breathe what we might think of as safe air within those vehicles. And that, of course, creates another whole situation that we really need to be aware of and to think about, because as we go about protecting ourselves from the air with future automated and smart technologies, of course, those very processes and technologies create more energy demand, and they require more resource extraction, more manufacturing, more transportation of the technology, which of course in turn will further damage the environment, the very environment that we're seeking to make ourselves safe from. So we've got to also think about the way in which we can actually benefit from these new technologies and how we can do that in such a way that actually doesn't damage the environment, that we're actually, because it's a kind of a vicious cycle, really, where if we damage the environment more, then we'll make our air less safe. And then we'll potentially, people will want to protect themselves even further. So how do we break that cycle and actually ensure that we protect ourselves from the environment while we're also protecting the environment from us?
Yeah, that's so true. It's like, I guess, remembering that the journey doesn't start with us buying the air quality sensor, for example. Mm-hmm. It starts way before. And so once we start thinking about that whole lifestyle, and then it also doesn't end when we throw it in the bin or whatever, or repurpose it. Yeah. There's that cycle, which, you know, the circular economy principles, but practically, what does that actually mean? And, you know, the more that we put up the armor to the environment, but we actually want to bring that armor down, and how we can, yeah, to that balancing act too. So yeah, thinking about those things is so important, and you know, not just thinking about them, obviously, but acting on them as well. But having those conversations, like, yeah, we can't just be like, oh yes, we'll just keep, you know, protecting ourselves, but actually we live in this world that we need to live in harmony with, right?
Absolutely, yes, yeah.
I'm keen to just go back quickly to the City of Melbourne project. Just can you give us, for people that wouldn't be aware of that project, can you just give us a little bit of a 101, and then, yes, I guess we already talked about some of those outcomes that you saw, but just what the initial scope was and what those outcomes were seeking from your perspective.
Yes, in this project, what we were actually aimed to do was to develop a design proposal for the City of Melbourne, which they would be able to take forward in order to enable people to understand city data and access and use city data, and to importantly, to align the values of the community with the values of the city, and also guided by our own values as researchers. Now, working on that project was fantastic because our colleagues at City of Melbourne and our values are very, very aligned, and that, you know, we're so committed to inclusivity, to ethics, to making sure that technology works for people. So it's a very exciting piece of work to do. And so, yes, that was our task, was for first week to understand the values and uses that people who used Argyle Square would have for city data, how they felt about data, how they experienced it being collected. And of course, as I said, if I was a sensor experiment, to really understand how we could put their human values into that process. But we also wanted to understand how to best communicate about city data to people, which is based on our ethnographic research. Then we also came up with this idea of the family of sensors and sort of think about how to best represent those. And so we came up with two ideas. One was a website in which we worked with an illustrator to create a family of sensors represented visually that the participants in our research citizens could see. And then also we created a series of sculptures, which we prototyped in our lab, working with an industrial designers on our team as well. So we prototyped them. They were big, made from cardboard, big sculptures painted different bright colours. And we took them out into Argyle Square and then worked with our City of Melbourne partners to, in city tours during Melbourne Knowledge Week, we actually asked participants to talk to us about what they, how they felt, and ask their questions about the sensors, making everything very visible, of course, with all of our signage and with the sculptures. But we also asked them to write on the sculptures too, so we could understand their concerns and their ambitions and the opportunities that they saw for city data. So, and that was amazing. We've still got all of the sculptures in our lab, all the prototype sculptures in our lab, and some really, really great words from people in the City of Melbourne asking about privacy, for example. One person wrote, you know, putting City of Melbourne on the tech map or something like that on as well. So people cared about the possibility of the sensor technology in a whole range of different ways. I mean, partly in pride for where they live, but also in relation to caring for themselves and their families and also their businesses, because we also, some local businesses were interested in how they could use the data to know, for example, how busy the square was or to plan and that kind of thing. Anyway, then we developed a proposal for the city. So we refined the design for the sculptures. We reported on all of our findings in relation to human values. And of course, our report's available through our Emerging Technologies Lab website, and people can download and read it there. But yes, but we've launched the report. The City of Melbourne's taking forward the process now into its next stage. So we were really excited to be able to really produce a design proposal for the City of Melbourne that's going to be used there, but also that we believe should be useful for a whole range of other communities and cities at different scales and different sizes, because we've developed a very rigorous methodology for researching, analysing, understanding and designing city sensing data futures, as we call them.
Yeah, no, awesome. Thanks so much for sharing that. I knew a little bit about the project, but it's always good to get the kind of insights, and yeah, I have to go and check it out. I'm going to be in Melbourne later in November. So, you know.
Yeah, you should definitely check out Argyle Square.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I also just saw that Tegan put up the platform for the park. So that's really exciting as well. So I've been checking that out as well. So yeah, no, thank you so much for sharing. Now, I've really enjoyed hearing about all those projects, but let's zoom to the future now. And can you tell us about some of the emerging trends that you think people aren't talking about enough?
Yes. So our Digital Energy Futures project, one of the things we've focused on is actually really trying to understand futures. And that's a big innovation for the social sciences. Most social scientists look towards the past and the present. And we've really been trying to understand how people will live in the futures. And there are a few core insights that come from that. One is, of course, the question about future air technologies, which I've already talked to you about. So I won't mention that one again. And I'll use a question about electric vehicles. Electric vehicles are starting to become increasingly popular, and there's lots of planning, lots of discussion about the infrastructures that need them for charging. How do we, you know, ensure that people have public charging stations they can use them at, or will people charge them? How do you make it possible for people to charge these cars at work? So lots of organizations and institutions kind of getting engaged with this question. But our digital energy futures research has indicated that nearly all of our participants want to charge their electric vehicles at home overnight, so that their vehicles are always ready for them at home to use when they need them. So that's definitely something that's not being spoken about enough. One of the other assumptions is that automated systems of electric vehicle charging will be really useful, and not only in terms of energy, you know, the energy grid and demand and that kind of stuff, but also convenient for people. Nearly all of our participants want to be in absolute control of their electric vehicle. They want to decide when it's charged, to the point that one participant actually went out into her garage to switch the electric vehicle on to charge overnight, and then got up in the morning to go and switch it off. So not even depending on an automated system to do what she asked she would like it to do, right? So I think what we really need to look to is this question of how much do people really want to stay in control of all of these systems and technologies in the future? How do we enable that in such a way that works for them and also works for the energy grid, works for our transition to net zero, as well as the kind of this transition to digitalization and for people in their lives and their transition to new technologies? So I think there are a few complex questions that are not being talked about, and they're not being talked about because they only come to the surface when you do real in-depth ethnographic research like we do with real people in their real lives, in their homes, in their workplaces, and in their cities. I think a lot of the debates are driven by technologists, by engineers, or by policymakers who don't really understand that real everyday life context. And what's so problematic and worrying is that their intentions are good, right, I think, but their assumptions about what people will do and how people will react to engage with and use technologies are really just assumptions. They're not based on real, hard, qualitative evidence. The kind of evidence that you get, or suggestions that you get from surveys, was really much too superficial. And there's a great dependence on surveys in the kinds of work and disciplines and organizations that plan for our futures. My call is that please engage more with qualitative insights and foresights and with real, because that's the only way that we can really bring the perspective of real people to the surface. And if we don't engage with the perspectives of real people and ask what real people will actually do with these technologies and systems in the future, then we're not going to achieve the objectives which we're seeking in terms of mitigating climate change and getting to net zero carbon emissions and making the best of digital technologies and benefiting from them in the ways that we really, really could.
Yeah, no, I think, yeah, it's calls to arms basically there. And I think it's really important because, I mean, we can glean a bit from, you know, the past and thinking about that, but actually, yeah, how will people use this in the future? Doesn't just depend on what's available. It depends on so many things, right? And similar to what we were talking about earlier, people don't react well if you're doing it to them, but if it's with them and you know, that sense of agency and control, I think is something that is key to how we design these things in the future as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And also really understanding what futures might be like. You know, if you ask people in a survey what they think about this or other thing in the future, give them three possible answers or a yes and no, you're not really going to learn very much about what that future might really be like and how those people will really feel in that future. So what we try to do in our research is actually create situations where people can experience what it might be like to really be in a future that they couldn't otherwise experience. You know, we can't predict the future, and the future is always uncertain, but we can get as near as possible by trying to simulate future experiences and situations and enabling people to be in those experiences and situations and tell us what it feels like, what decisions they might make based on the experience of that situation, rather than just asking them in a very detached way what they might do in the future. You know, that depth of knowledge and that kind of possibility to tap on people's real experience is just so, so important.
Yeah, I agree. It's like giving them a little slice of the future, right? And seeing in real time how they react.
That's what we've done that in particularly we've done that experiments with the collaborations I've done with Halmstad University and Volvo Cars in Sweden. So we've had people drive in Wizard of Oz cars, so cars which are actually simulated self-driving cars, the drivers or the passenger people in them think are self-driving. And those kinds of ways of inviting people to experience a possible future that isn't actually really possible in real life yet can just be so rich in helping us to understand what they would really do in such situations.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a really interesting one, and you glean so much from that as well. Yeah, and I even just thinking about your like the smart home project as well. Like, not that that doesn't necessarily all the technology exists now, and there may be smaller futures, but it's actually enabling it for a community that may not be able to access it now, but then seeing how they actually use it, so then we can design it better for them in the future as well.
Yeah, absolutely, because the people who participated in that study would not have had that technology otherwise. So I think we can very kind of confidently say that we weren't putting them into a future in a sense, but we were putting them into a reality that would never have been part of their usual reality, right? The one that they expected. So we put them into situations that, completely changed the ways in which the way that their home was experienced, because it was populated with a whole set of new technologies.
Well, Sarah, it's been so great to have you on the podcast. I hope we can definitely have another chat in the future and also meet in person someday when we're in the same place. But yeah, it's been so great to have you on the podcast. So thanks so much for coming on.
Excellent. Thanks so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, just one last question. How can people connect with you?
So we are the Emerging Technologies Research Lab. We're at Monash University. So you can find us on the Monash website, and I think that link's going to be available.
We are
very busy on all social media channels. So please find us on LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook. You can follow our events, our activities, find out what's going on, and get in touch with us.
Excellent. Thanks again for coming onto the podcast. And yeah, I look forward to our future conversation.
Thank you.
Okay.
Are you looking for an engaging speaker, MC, or facilitator for your next big event? Then we've got you covered. Zoe is a go-to speaker, MC, and conversation facilitator with a difference. She's a master at simplifying the complex and making connections you might never see. Book Zoe for your next event. Email hello@mysmart.community. Or head over to her speaker page, www.mysmart.community/speaking.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart Community Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes are available on our website, mysmart.community/podcast. If you have any questions for us or any of our guests, you can email hello@mysmart.community. You can also find us on the socials. We are on LinkedIn and Twitter @smartcomhq. That's com with two M's. If you are enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode. And we would love for you to leave us a rating and review at wherever you listen. This really helps us reach more ears and eyes, so thank you for your support. As always, we hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.